Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, we're going to be hearing from Hawaii, Professor Elizabeth Satoris. We're going to talk about understanding the clash of worldviews and paradigms today, and why the need for a future living economy to sustain the preservation of our species that is so urgent. It is my opinion that we are not addressing the major issues through each of the major media showing us the true nature, unfiltered, of our problems, nor through any of our legislative bodies, certainly at the federal level, as well as state, of what to do. We're not being told what to do for the fires that raged this year in California and Washington and Oregon, Montana, the flooding in Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida, and Texas. We're not given positive solutions. We're given promises that are never fully exercised. We're even in a situation right now where, in the very near future, possibly days, the United States will commit itself to attacking Syria. The entire corporate beltway, pundits, hundreds of thousands of technocrats, highly educated people, mainly with think tanks, and they're all pro-war. They need an intervention. And we have so few people. The only one in the media thus far is Tucker Carlson on Fox. He had the courage to say, hold on a second. We did this in Libya. It was a false flag. There was no threat that Libya posed to the United States or anyone else. Look at Libya today. We did this in Syria. Look at Syria today. We're not looking at Iraq today. We're not looking at Vietnam today or Afghanistan today, because if we did, we would see a toll of over $6 trillion, tens of thousands of dead Americans, millions of dead civilians in those other countries, and environments destroyed. And yet, learning nothing, we're about to go ahead and do this again. My guest has a strong background in evolution biology. She's a philosopher, a futurist, a former professor specializing in designs of living systems at MIT and the University of Massachusetts. Dr. Satoris has served as a consultant to the United Nations on Indigenous Peoples and has been a leading voice in promoting the Gaia hypothesis of James Lovelock. She's a fellow of the World Business Academy and has been an advisor to graduate business programs at universities, and currently she is teaching the graduates for MBAs at the University in Hawaii. She is the author of several important books, not the least of which is a book about the environment, Biology Revised. And also, she is the author of Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution. Her website is Satoris, I'll spell that, SHTORIS.com. Nice once again to have you back.
We're witnessing a clash between many different ideologies and worldviews, and it's confusing to people. There are heated debates and friction between the proponents of medical and scientific determinism against the practitioners and advocates for alternative health. Worldviews of nationalism and race and class and religion are clashing with more integrated humanitarian and spiritual views on the economy of all people rather than their differences. Wars between the believers in conventional industrial agriculture and those who support sustainable, organic, local farming. There are divisions between economic systems, neoliberal capitalism, socialism, recent of Marxist theories. Of the fight between left and right, religion and spiritual versus atheism and rationalism. And there are many more struggles and disagreements between worldviews. And on the surface, it would appear that today, humanity is more divided than at any other time in our history. So I would like you to explain to us how it was formed. Do not use in any of our schools. None of the high schools teach it. Junior highs don't teach it. Most colleges don't teach it. And if so, it's only one unique professor who believes that students should have a worldview. And as a result, students are very ill-prepared to confront what we face. Well, I'd like for you to answer that. And all we are immersed in dogma. I think of worldviews as ideological constructs. You've suggested instead of defining these constellations of ideas and thoughts and emotions and beliefs as worldviews, we may want to think of them as vistas. So hopefully you'll explain what you mean by that and that bring out a clash and wars between worldviews or vistas. And finally, how do we distinguish between a vista that is authentic from one that is delusional? Because it seems to me that this is where universal ethics and morals play an important role. And just as a caveat, speak the be seeing the preparation for a new war in Syria. Now that a man named Bolin is the top advisor on national security issues to the president, and he is a hyper war hawk, the Joint Chiefs of Staff pro-war, of the people in the White House, including his top man, whoever gets the team, a general. So he surrounded himself with a neocon base. And then this morning, all of the major media, and especially MSNBC and the liberal media, were banging the drums that he must intervene. In fact, if you remember Dr. Dean, who was running several years ago as a anti-war presidential candidate, is not just a retaliatory act, but the complete elimination of Assad and his regime. Now, while all this is going on, I only heard one single rational voice, Tucker Carlson. Now, and he was the only one who said, hey, we've been down this road before, and we were wrong, and the experts were wrong. And if you want to look at, you know, people dying and children dying, why don't you look at the countries that are being invaded by our allies and us, like Saudi Arabia and in Yemen? Over 100,000 children are at risk of dying, and tens of thousands have died, and there's the largest cholera outbreak in the world there. And we're bombing the country back into the Stone Age. No one's talking about that. No one's talking about, look at Libya, where the largest open air raid in the world, talking about the white helmets and how on this program we're the first to expose them. We challenged Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman for her support of the white helmets. We challenged the Academy system for giving it an Academy Award for short documentary. They're terrorists. And everyone who's supposedly the Free Syrian Army, they're terrorists. And that's well documented. We do not believe that Assad at this point dared to do anything with chemical weapons because he's winning. So if you could, I'm not asking you to address that person. I'm just asking you to address what happens when you have a tiny group of peaceful people and a huge political apparatus and media that will re-engage in another war. We've learned nothing from Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and any of the other places that we've been. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much, Gary. I really appreciate being here on the show again. It's been a long time. And aloha to everyone out there from Hawaii. As Gary has just said, these are the most turbulent times. In Hawaiian language, I would say we are navigating through a perfect storm of crises that we've brought on ourselves, and in many ways, it's a natural evolutionary development for us. We've been going through, through my evolution biologist lenses, we've been going through a great youthful phase in our technological culture where we just kept making things without looking at the messes we were making, and we beat each other up over them, and all of those things are happening. And now it's come to a culmination point when we have the kind of situation Gary's been describing, and we don't know from one day to another what's going to happen next. What I can say for the current administration is it's the most attention-getting one we've ever had. Never before have people been so aware of every cabinet change and everything that's going on. And that's a good thing. We're paying attention at last. And we're not asleep anymore, so we can wake up. Now, you want me to talk about vistas. This is my shortcut word for worldview, which was kind of a shortcut from the original German Weltanschauung. So vista is a nice Latin word, so it crosses languages well. And what is a vista? When you're up high and you have a big, broad view, you call it a vista. Now, the word vista is made up of two shorter words, vita and visa, that if you imagine them in your mind, you can slide them together and get a vista. Now, vita means life, and visa means getting where you want to go, right? You need a visa to get where you want to go. You need a vista to live your life. And everyone has one, although most of us are not the least bit aware that we have such a thing as a worldview or as a vista. Now, my definition of a vista is all the things you consider facts about the world, plus the values you hold that help you navigate those facts, as you call them. Now, I'm a scientist, and I have come to the conclusion that there probably are no such things as facts for humans, because everything that we experience comes through our mind, and our mind is made of thoughts and beliefs and things like that. So we choose to call things we encounter in life facts. Like, I say, it's a fact that the sun comes up every morning. Actually, it doesn't. The planet is just rolling toward the sun so that we get to see it, right? So science tells us more and more about the beliefs that we hold and tries to refine things. But science itself is based on a worldview. And you see, you cannot make a theory about a universe if you have no idea what a universe is. So first you have to have a few concepts down about your universe, then you can make theories about how does it work. Well, the founding fathers of Western science, which is now the science taught all over the world, started in Europe, and the founding fathers were very interested in mechanics, the robot clock tower. Beings were new and you know, they were fascinated by clocks, and they invented telescopes and microscopes and all these things. So they saw the universe as a lot of matter that was bumping into each other, you know, like made of particles that bump into each other. And so it was a purely material universe, which was very different from the universe everyone had believed in before that, which was more spiritual, more religious, a God-created nature, and a nature with God as an external creator of it. In Eastern religions, it went differently. Nature itself was God, in a sense. God was immanent in nature. So we had very different worldviews all along around the world, and everybody grew up learning one of them and adopting it. And now we have communication systems. We can talk to each other. We can see how different our worldviews are. And we have to decide every day what to believe or not to believe. Am I going on too long here?
No, please continue.
Okay. So we have to keep looking at our own belief systems, at our own view of the world and our place in it, and treat it kind of like a garden of beliefs. You plant them, they grow, you water some of them, you let some of them die, and you can take charge and actively start to weed out the ones that don't serve you anymore. And hopefully you will tend this garden of beliefs, this vista of yours, all your life, and keep on planting new ideas and letting old ones fade away and and taking care of the good ones that serve you. So look at those values by which you're steering. Are they the usual human values we hear about in ethics? Are we caring, sharing people who want to take care of each other, who want to have a world in which our economies include everyone? If we're steering by those kinds of values, and we call them in Hawaii, we call those the aloha values, and they're all about respect and mutual aid. In Africa, they call it Ubuntu. They're wonderful values that many people now are trying to put in place as we navigate through this perfect storm of crises to try to create a better world for ourselves. But if we don't even know what's running us, that our own stories are running us, we're in trouble because it's very difficult to sort out what's real, what's not real. Well, that gets us into the whole question of how we define reality. And I have a, what's called in Hawaii, a Hanai son, an informally adopted son, whose name is Puma, and he lives in the Peruvian Andes. He's the most highly trained medicine priest, probably, of anyone his age in the Andes. And in his culture, reality is defined as everyone's experience. Now, that's very interesting. I looked into dictionaries in our culture, and most definitions of reality include the word real, which makes them quite useless. It doesn't help me to say reality is what's real. I'm still stuck with the same problem. What's real? So anyway, I finally found a Webster's Online Dictionary in which the fourth definition was reality is non-derivative experience. Now that means your personal experience, and it's exactly what Puma's culture says reality is. Now in Puma's culture, they have certain rules, and one of them is about integrity. When you tell me your worldview, your story, don't distort it to manipulate me. Tell it true, and I will accept it as your reality without having to make it mine. Now, think about the ethics, the deep ethics of that concept, that we can accept people having different worldviews from ours and still have enough in common to build a global family culture on. So knowing our worldviews, knowing what we believe, and giving space to other people to believe somewhat differently or maybe even very differently from us, then we can get along with each other. Anyway, I got very interested in this understanding that science itself was based on a worldview made up of some so-called facts about the universe, which are really just the beliefs of whoever gets to make the foundations of science. And Western science is founded on the belief that this is a non-living universe. It's made of matter and energy. We can study it without interfering in it as if we're apart from it, like God and nature in religion. And then consciousness is a late emergent product of a long string of accidents that leads to humans and brains in biological evolution. Now, that puts consciousness last in evolution, in a sense. And there are other sciences, like the Eastern Vedic sciences, the Taoist sciences of China, Islamic science based on their more ancient Arabic science. And I have looked at the worldviews of all these. I have held symposia, international symposia, bringing those scientists together and having them actually write out what the fundamental vista of their science is. And very interestingly, you discover that while Western science is a material, a matter-based worldview, Eastern sciences are usually consciousness-based, or Islamic science, the first premise after Allah created the universe is he created a living universe and told us to study it like any other science would. So we have these very different sciences, And one of the problems with my own Western science is that when quantum theorists started founding quantum theory, they had to look to Vedic science in the East for a worldview because the material worldview they had been taught didn't work to explain what they found when they dug through matter and into pure energy fields like the quantum field. So in my vista, I realized that both the quantum scientists and the Newtonian-Einsteinian physicists, most all of them would agree that the universe is made of vibrations. And you can picture vibrations as a keyboard, an endlessly long keyboard, but like on a piano, so that the low keys are in the world of matter, and the middle range keys are in the world of electromagnetic energy. And Einstein showed us with his famous E equals mc squared equation that matter and energy are interchangeable, that you can transpose music up and down the keyboard that far. But when you go further up the keyboard, Western science has a very hard time because they lose the ability to measure what's going on with their physical instruments, which is how they verify things and establish the facts of Western science. But the Eastern science start, the Eastern scientists, like the Vedics, they start at the high end of the keyboard where it's pure consciousness, spirit, mind coming down, slowing down into a quantum field, which slows down into electromagnetic energy, which then slows down into matter. So they were able to derive the whole keyboard that is you and me and everyone else and everything else. We are not bodies with a mind and a soul or whatever with consciousness. We are body, mind, spirits. We can play the whole keyboard because we're in physical bodies, and we can reach all the way up to the whole universe through meditation. So that's the basis of my vista, is to recognize that that's the kind of beings we are. But it's up to each of us now, and think about it. Probably even in your own family, you have people with different worldviews, because we're no longer tied to one cultural authority that tells us what we have to think. We're allowed to grow our own vista gardens and to change them as we go.
I appreciate that extended answer. Thank you. Sometimes I feel it's important to consider neuroscientific discoveries with brain imaging with respect to beliefs. And there have been some important findings in this area. For example, at New York University, MRI study found that people who identify with being more liberal and progressive on causes they support had stronger activity in the brain's anterior cingulate, which deals with our mind's ability to meditate thoughts and to mediate actions, and that are in conflict with each other. And this would mean that they are better able to deal with complexity. They can alter habitual patterns and are more open to change and the ideas and beliefs of others. On the other hand, staunch conservatives show far less willingness or ability to change, and their brains are not changing, especially in the amygdala and the limbic areas where emotional fear responses are animated, which would relate to finding safety within one's tribe. And also, those hold the same vistas. So you have a whole tribe seeing the world, and they're frequently fearful of what they see, and hence they're not mediating these fears and saying, are these realistic fears? For example, Tucker Carlson said on his program last evening with a Republican senator who prides himself on how conservative he is, exactly what does the United States gain by going in and invading Syria? What? And he said, well, you know, we want to defend Israel. Well, Israel's more than capable of defending itself, and behind almost every action in the Middle East, you'll find its hidden hand. And that's the power of AIPAC and the the phenomenal lobby they have. It's even stronger and more effective than the NRA. But that means that virtually everyone in a position of power within that vista view perceive everything around the world as either a fear or an opportunity to overcome a fear and supplant what's there, a sovereign nation, a president, a union leader, with someone that they choose to be with or choose to have. And so that's simply a matter of, you know, neuroscience. And if our biology is also an important organ or function for the creation of our beliefs and behaviors, what might be the best way to deal with those who present themselves as our adversaries?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I did read that study, and it certainly is a very interesting study. And it's something that, you know, we it's nice to have the corroboration, because it seems obvious that if you grow up in a single vista and you just kind of learn to parrot it back, and we know that fundamentalist literature is about half the literature printed in this entire country. I mean, most of us don't know that. It was shocking to me to discover it. And most of that fundamentalist literature is the same stories with different clothing and characters. You know, it's drummed in a single vista, as you said. And so the brain doesn't have the experience of remaining flexible. It really does kind of harden up, and it makes it more and more difficult to break out of that. And we know that also from when we release people from cults and how much work it takes to undo the what I call brain clogging rather than brain washing. The washing has to take place to undo the clogging, doesn't it? And so we do see that in the world today. And in my biological worldview, there's a maturation cycle that all species have been going through since the very first ones 4 billion years ago. You know, half of evolution, there were only bacteria on the planet. And they duked it out and did all kinds of crazy things and caused some global problems of the same kinds that we humans have created. They caused global hunger and they caused global pollution, and they solved both of them without benefit of brain and ended up forming the kind of cells we are made of ourselves as cooperatives. So I started to see this maturation process where the youthful mode is feisty, competitive, hostile, grabby, all of those things. And eventually there comes a point when the crises are so great that you start to negotiate with some of your enemies because you just can't afford to kill them anymore. And you discover that it's possible to make friends of them, to have allies, and to save all those energy resources, in our human case, money, if you start supporting each other instead of fighting each other. So we're seeing these extremes now. We're seeing the last-ditch stand of adolescence. And we see it before our eyes on every late-night comedy show. You almost can't help satirizing the current situation, because it's just... A cartoonist couldn't have thought it up. And yet it's here to wake us up, to say, look, people, we don't have to live this way. Change your story, change your life. Look at alternative stories. Look at those people on the other side of the planet. You know, some of the best conflict resolution teams I know, and I have never met a conflict resolution team that couldn't resolve conflicts. But we don't spend any money on it because war is way too profitable. War and drugs are the biggest businesses in the world. And as long as they are money makers, we're going to be stuck with them. So I like to say to the younger generation, it's quite easy for you to build a better world. Just look at all the things your elders are doing that you disapprove of and don't do them anymore. One generation could end war by make love, not war, as we said in the 60s. And finally, the young people are coming out again, and their worldview is shifting, and they are seeing that they have power, that they can gather in Washington, in cities all around the world, that they can start saying, this is enough. We're not doing this. We're not living this way. That is how the world changes. That is how we will move, like all other species, from a feisty adolescence to a mature, collaborative community. And if you look at indigenous cultures, as I have a great deal, they grew up, most of them, a long time ago. They figured out that it makes more sense, that it's cheaper to feed your enemies than to kill them. They figured out that collaboration is the way. And the newest evolution biology that's coming out is all about cooperation. I'm assigning my MBA students, business students, a book called Teeming, spelled T-E-E-M-I-N-G, called How Superorganisms Work to Build Infinite Wealth in a Finite World, and points out that we are ant-like apes, not just apes. We're not just competitive, beating our chests and playing King of the Hill. We also live by the millions in cities all day long, stopping at red lights, paying at the supermarket, being friendly to each other as we bump into each other on the street. We do so many cooperative things, and yet it's not news. But it is news. It is news that we as a species are more cooperative than we are competitive. And if we just really get that and build our local economies that way, it's spreading. That news is spreading. And we have the technology to build these huge collaborative platforms. And even, you know, I've been watching with great interest the Facebook story. We have Mark Zuckerberg almost playing the victim now, like, I didn't know and we didn't know, and how can we help it? And he's being pushed into building greater security and recognizing that it's a huge commercial venture, and that, you know, selling people's data is there for the people who made him rich and who run the show through money. Money is still running the world, and yet we are now seeing all kinds of new kinds of money coming out from community currencies to blockchain currencies, and they're rising and falling, and they're being taken over, and they're making people rich, and eventually we're going to have a whole new internet that is fair and can't be commercialized. I have a new young man who's one of my newest mentees in Korea, who's designing Decenternet with that in mind. And he's a young man with a spiritual mission to enable people to talk to each other all over the world without being exploited by these commercial interests or these war-making interests. So you asked me right at the beginning, how do we tell authentic from delusional vistas? That's exactly why we have to keep looking at our garden, being aware of it, weeding it. It's horrendous that Facebook has become a bigger source of news than newspapers and television news shows and everything else. And even they have become suspect now. So truth can only be gauged really in your gut, in your heart, your gut. You sense when things are authentic or not. And every one of us has the responsibility to try to figure out what's going on in our world, what makes the most sense, what hangs together as a vista. And you have to educate yourself. Also, as you said, Gary, it's not being taught in the schools. So it's up to us to look at our vistas and to look at, everybody, find what makes your heart sing. What do you love doing most? Do you want to write music? Do you want to paint pictures? Do you want to do scientific research? Do you want to build gadgets, grow food, whatever? Find something that makes your heart sing, that you want to do in a way that you want to still be around when your children, your great-grandchildren even, I have great-grandchildren now, you know, in their world. And it's their world. They're going to have to build it out of the wreckage that's coming up fast now.
Very good on that. I'm going to share a different position. I'm going to posit something I call, I just was writing and it just came into my head, essential simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm seeing it differently from my perspective, and let me tell you how I'm seeing it, and then please address it.
Yes.
I'm seeing that we don't have to have the old operation mind controls that we had MK Ultra in the 1950s and 60s. Instead, I'm seeing that Facebook and social media is the new way that we are, in effect, conditioning ourselves. It's a more insidious form of propaganda, and until it creates a single belief, no matter what your background, that this is where you get your information. This is what's reliable. And I remember the 1970s, Senator Church had hearings, and it really shocked the world because here's the CIA director up there talking about how they control the media. They have hundreds of people that are their assets in all the major media. We know that Mr. Luce, who owned Time Warner, or Time and Life magazine at the time, was playing a part in that. And that never went away. And no one went back to revise their idea and say how much of what we're taught each day about what to value and who to value and who to trust and who not to trust. And they're not asking people to think with their hearts, as you're suggesting, which is intuition, that eternal energy we're all given. Instead, they're turning it off. They're saying, trust us. So on the one hand, I absolutely am in alignment with you that Mark Zuckerberg, who is fabulously wealthy, never matured. We confuse kind of that that brilliance to do something that creative and to be that much power within him from someone who becomes humble. The more successful and wealthy he is, he turns inward to continue his spiritual quest and learn the deeper lessons of life. All these people who become successful, almost all to a fault, will continue amassing their fortunes. Then it's a race as who's going to be number one, who's going to be number two, and they'll throw money at some of their selected charities, and mostly those charities are self-serving in any case. And so we ask, by the time a person today is 20 years of age, they know nothing about the world or any tribe that you would have met. They know nothing about the Bushmen of the Kalahari and how they live in a communal setting, and never do they allow the environment they've just been in to be overwhelmed by their presence. They even bury ostrich shells with water for the next person that they will never see, who'll know where to dig, and there's some water for them. They don't know about that. They don't know there are 54 countries in Africa. They couldn't name one. They don't know where any of Eastern Europe. They couldn't tell you Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Lithuania. They don't know that. They don't care. When interviewed on the street, these college students said they don't care about that. They don't even know who fought the Civil War or the American Revolution or when it was fought or over what it was fought. And now we see one person coming forward who's the new liberal media darling on gun control. Now, of course, any reasonable person wants some form of gun control to prevent many of the things with assault rifles that we see, but that doesn't change the underlying social pathology that allows people the mindset that they believe that they can kill. We're not even talking about pharmaceuticals in our society. So we exclude pharmaceuticals, we exclude the war on drugs, we exclude Citizens United and who buys elections and politicians, we exclude universal health care, we exclude cleaning up our environment, we exclude sustainable agriculture, we support industrial agriculture. So every single thing that would allow us to learn a lesson from our past, correct it, and go forward, we exclude. And that's not the individual excluding, because individuals learn from policymakers and opinion leaders. The opinion leaders are the deep state behind the scenes and the technological instruments they use, Google, Facebook, and Wikipedia. And the people in the media, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Rachel Maddow, they all are harping to the same tune, maybe from an ideological perspective, but all of what they say benefits one group of people. And those people have so conditioned people, they're not going to decondition them. There's no safe house to take people to, say, everything you've been taught was propaganda, originated by Edward Bernays back in the beginning of the 20th century. There's no place for people to go today in mass and get deconditioned so that they can then become sensitive to what we need to cooperate and live together. And this one guy is just a perfect example of that. He went before the cameras. He's done hundreds of interviews. And I listened carefully to what I had to say. And not parsing it down, but he was using the F word constantly. He was then attacking people. If you didn't support his position, then you were no better than a child killer. And that reminds me of Hillary Clinton. I lost the election because of the deplorable. 4 million Americans are deplorable. And we have so galvanized this hate volleyball game that is engaged between the Democrats and Republicans, right and left, the conservative and the corporate liberal establishment, that unless something collapses, unless there's a catastrophic event, unless something really smacks us to the ground, I personally do not see any utopia from this dystopia. I do not see people who feel entitled, privileged, separate, better than, having the humility as kids around the world have, who've gone through the struggles kids around the world have, the privations, learning. I see a very arrogant, narcissistic young group of people coming up, and we may have to go another generation before we see the change that you're talking about. Your response, please.
Yes, well, I have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and I kind of think it's my great-grandchildren's generation that are going to be doing the most work. As for getting smacked down, you bet we're going to get smacked down. Jim Hansen, who is the best climate scientist in the United States, told me quite a few years ago that while scientists would like to have sea level rise go at nice predictable curves, a centimeter at a time, or even a millimeter at a time, how on earth you measure that, I don't know. But it's not going to work that way. It's going to come in jumps, in leaps. And the skirt ice around both Antarctica and Greenland now is very spongy or gone in some places already. And once that's gone, nothing will prevent the higher ground ice from sliding off in huge masses, which will create huge tsunamis. And as one BBC program about a Canary Island volcano that they're expecting to blow says at the end, we cannot tell you just when this will happen. We can tell you it will happen. There is no more way to reverse climate change, and it will become the driver for moving us into mature mode for the simple reason that, you know, you see already whenever there's a catastrophe, people rally together in most incredibly cooperative ways, whether it's in Puerto Rico or in Japan or wherever it is in the world. The less people have, the more they share. And very few people become looters in those situations, and they're quickly ostracized. This is how people get together. Now, you would think with the kind of mind brains we have that we would see ahead and start adapting to what's coming down the pike sooner, but it looks more and more to me like we're just going to be driven and many people will lose their lives. Consider just this one fact. Of the 20 largest cities in the world, 13 of them are at sea level, and every coastal city has both its airport and its pier at sea level. If the sea level jumps 1 meter or 3 meters or 5 meters, which can happen overnight, they lose all ability to export or import anything. That is the case with our Hawaiian Islands now, and why we are trying to teach how we can take care of ourselves. When that happens, we're going to lose our beaches first. It won't take more than a half a meter to wipe out most of our beaches, and that will really cut our tourism down, right? Well, I won't go into the Hawaiian details, but climate change is real. It's past a tipping point. Jim Lovelock used to say to me in the late 70s or in the 80s, pray for an ice age. We're due for one, but if we tip this thing into a hot age, it's going to be harder on us. And I made trips to places like Morocco to see how did people live well in deserts thousands of years ago. They did. They knew how to live well in deserts. So I know that humans can do it. And when oil companies ask me, how do you see our future? I say, water. You have pipeline technology. You're going to be moving water around because there's going to be more of it than we want where we don't want it and not enough of it where we need it. So these things will happen, and some of humanity will survive. I hope everyone out there will be among the survivors. I cannot tell you when the sea level will start jumping, seriously jumping, but we are already here experiencing washout of our northern shore with some houses falling off the edge, and we're already getting climate refugees here. Some Pacific islands have had to be completely evacuated already. So, and Miami is, you know, the fish are swimming in the streets because the sewage is backing up. And it's getting very real. It's going to get realer. And we've got to go back into community and taking care of each other. And that's it. So it's not that I'm disagreeing with you, Gary. I do think it's that bad a situation. And if we could only get that in nature, a democracy would mean that you have progressives and conservatives, both in different parties, but not that you vote for 4 years, you're only going to be progressive, and for 4 years, then you're only going to be conservative, but that you conserve what works and you change progressively what does not work, and that is a cooperative arrangement in nature. If we could get that one concept down and stop letting us be divided by the powers that be that don't want you to get that, don't want you to understand that democracy is about everybody working together in a division of labor, then, you know, we're sunk if we can't get concepts as simple as that.
I'm in alignment with you. I would add to that that it is not just that a Democrat or Republican has an administration and has a particular ideological bent. What I'm suggesting is that there are about 200,000 military-industrial complex contractors in Washington. There's at least another 60,000 lobbyists and professionals representing the pharmaceutical industry and the banking industry and the food industry and the energy industry. And these people have a fiefdom. They virtually are beyond reproach. The media is in their pocket. The legislators are in their pocket. So what I see happening is I see natural cataclysmic events happening, and they not being able to respond to them, the people losing confidence in them. For example, I'll give you a really good example because it happened to me. I have a ranch in Florida where I do recovery, you know, rescue of animals, get them healthy and happy and get them into larger sanctuaries or our homes, and up comes the storm, the worst storm to hit all of Florida in its history, and it was a Category 4 at 158 miles an hour, major damage, and afterwards, I had prepared. I had, you know, generators, I had backup propane, I had food stored, so I went to my neighbor saying, I'm here to help you, and, you know, do you want to store your food? I have a walk-in refrigerator. So anything I could do to help them, let them use water. But then in the process of talking to my neighbors, I ask them a simple question. And this is what gets down to that concept of the virtual simplicity, with the essential simplicity. What did you learn from this storm that could help you because the next storm is coming, probably within 9 months? Because this one happened at the end of the hurricane season. And they looked at me and says, we don't know. Are you going to move? Are you going to try to prevent the damage that was done this time? By the way, we were without electricity on my street for 3 months. 3 months. And even today, when I call home, I'm finding out that they're still cleaning up, working 7 days a week, all day. That's how much cleanup it was. And yet, by the time it's cleanup, the fire season's starting right now. And then after the fire season, the hurricane season. So we're in a negative feedback loop that Hansen predicted. Also, you mentioned a volcano that could go off. Well, what about the large volcano under Yellowstone, the largest volcano in the world? It's under Yellowstone National Park. If it just creates one flute, just one, you've got a Mount St. Helena times 100. If it creates 2 to 5 flutes, you will have at least 1/3 of the entire continental United States, all the Midwest, all where our food is grown, out to California and North Dakota, where a lot of our wheat is grown, down to Texas. That's going to be so adversely affected by the soot and by the darkening where sunlight doesn't get through and by the inability to breathe, because when soot goes into your lung and it hits moisture, it creates almost like concrete, and people die because their lungs are coated, they're breathing it in, and they can't get it out. We've made no plans whatsoever for that. We've made no plans if power goes out in any community in the United States that has a nuclear power plant for more than 30 days, that plant's going to blow. Then we got a Fukushima. We have no means right now to correct that. If a solar storm hits, the same. And I lived in Miami. I lived in South Beach for 15 years, right on the water. And I sold my place because one night I walked over to Alton Road, which goes up the bay on the west side of South Beach, about 8 blocks wide, to Lincoln Road. The water was 28 inches deep. And I said, what, a water main break? No, that's just the normal tidal surge at night. So they invested some $220 million to take that water and put it back into the bay. Well, the bay is connected to the ocean. So the bay water goes around back into the ocean. They've not done anything, and they haven't told the people to move. The people in California, the worst fires in their history this past year, no one's moving. In Oregon, no one's moving. In Montana, the worst fires in their history, no one's moving. Louisiana, the worst flooding in their history this year. The worst flooding in Texas history, 21 trillion gallons of water in 5 days, bringing water so high with a clay cap that it caused chemicals to spill out into the soil, which can never be cleaned up. No one's moving. They're getting environmental disease there. Antarctica now is shown to have 81, it was 81, now it's up to 110 volcanoes underneath the ice, and the water's melting it. And now we're in what Hansen originally hinted at, but now it's been absolutely confirmed. We're in chaos theory, meaning the tipping point has tipped. There's nothing in the human experience that we will see that can compete with this. And when the conveyor belt stops taking warm water from the Caribbean and taking it up around the northern parts of Europe, you can go into another very cold era. In the last ice age, 11,000 years ago, you said Morocco, the people learned how to survive in the desert. Well, people actually survived in northern Europe in the last ice age, 11,000 years ago. But it was not a time to thrive. It was surviving. So we are doing nothing about the environment, nothing, and won't until there's a cataclysmic event. And then there will be a push out of the people in power because our lives will be so completely disrupted. And also, Wall Street is a big bubble about to burst. There's going to be a major correction. And then you have disease that is, we're the sickest nation in the world per population on the planet. So just imagine disease, epidemic, 1/3 of all Americans are obese, 1/3 have diabetes or prediabetes, economy where you have 250 million poor people, and an environment that is wrecking havoc, and nowhere are we doing anything about any of that. So your thoughts on what individuals should do and how they should look at maybe the Gaia hypothesis you talk about and how we've plundered the Earth for fossil fuels, and, of course, we're causing 200 species a day to go extinct. All of this is endangering the planet's equilibrium. As an analogy, it is fine to take a little blood from a patient, but beyond a certain point, like George Washington, he had a cold and they bled him to death. Benjamin Rush, the signer of the Declaration of Independence, the first psychiatrist, bled him to death. And so we are bleeding our society to death, and we are not paying attention to the anthropomorphic activity that is weakening the Earth's metabolism, spewing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and literally reshaping the planet's geology and biosystems. So do we not have a responsibility at some point to deal with Gaia, to deal with the reality we're faced with before it takes us and undoes us?
Well, of course, Gary, and you're doing very important work to wake people up, to expose them to these things that are going on our planet. And of course, if we don't clean our oceans up, we're sunk just because of that. If ocean life dies, land life can't be far behind in dying. So we can actually take the planet all the way back to single-celled organisms, and then they'll start all over and do the show again. And we won't be missed. But I would urge you to also give some hope to the young people, because your message could lead people to either decide party while we can, or hide in our cell phones and talk to each other trivia. So it's not true that there's nothing going on. There's a great deal going on all over the world. There are huge projects happening in Africa and South America and
I was referring to the United States.
All across the United States, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, BALLE, look that up, because it, founded by Judy Wicks and myself and others through the Social Venture Network in the mid-90s, that has really spread, and people are going to it as a resource. And there are so many places. There's the Mondragon Cooperatives in Spain, in which they decided themselves that no one should earn more than 8 times the lowest salary in the whole culture. While we are dealing with, here in Hawaii, 37% of people who are working 40 hours a week, both parties in a couple working, cannot meet basic needs anymore. So we're against that in the crunch, and my MBA students are going into the business world. So I'm going to teach them to become solutionaries. That, you know, knowing that the tourist industry will fall, what are we going to do instead? How are we going to feed ourselves when Walmart and Costco can't import our stuff anymore because our peers are gone? And so there is so much going on. And the fact that we have collaborative platforms, many of which are being used to help each other, to spread values like Ubuntu. There are magazines like Cosmos and Yes Magazine, all available online. There's the Daily Optimist that you can subscribe to for nothing, which will cheer you up every morning with 4 or 5 positive things going on in the world. So I say, with Rumi, my favorite poet, why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? We are free people still who can invent our own currencies. We can build our own communities. We can talk to our neighbors. We can make collective plans. We can try to be proactive, knowing disasters are coming. Find out where our energies can be best used to do what we can where we are, to build our local security, and to keep praying for the world, because I don't any longer believe I can change the whole world, but I can encourage people to change where they, change their own vistas, their own stories. Remember, the only thing you can really lose is your body, right? You are a spirit having a human experience, and with a body you can play that whole keyboard. You can be matter, spirit, energy all at once. If we lose our bodies, we'll go on. We'll be non-material beings, right?
Elizabeth.
So we might as well do our best and bless everybody out there. Find something you love and do it so that other people will want to do it with you.
I fully agree with you, by the way. I'm working on intentional communities. We're every single day we share information on how to solve problems. The difference is, and I love Rumi also, but I would say let us make people aware that they've been living within the prison of social consciousness, and we must realize that we're in a prison before we'll free ourselves to manifest our destiny in a way that is constructive, spiritual, and cooperative. It's just that I tend to show people everything that I know that could be a problem for them to prevent them from being in harm's way. And then it's up to them to wake up and to say, yes, I'm awake. You've got my attention. Now what can I do?
Great.
Right? And I see that happening. So we will complete our program today in concurrence that we have a lot of problems, but we also have the great potential to solve them. And mm-hmm. if not collectively as an entire society, at least individually in groups and people who want to start doing things now and educating yourself about the seriousness of the problem is as important as how creative you can be in the solution. So thank you for all your good work. I really enjoyed our conversation. I look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Gary.
Dr. Elizabeth Satoris from Hawaii, a wonderful and unique mind as part of our series on Conversations with Remarkable Minds. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.